नभोले तिमी सँग नभोले तिनै नभई नहै मेरो तिमीलाई नहेरे
Hi, listeners, welcome back to Immigrantly. I am your host, Sadia Khan. As we all know, the pandemic has changed all of our lives in more ways than one. As of this October, the New York Times reported nearly 45 million cases and almost 725,000 deaths in the United States. The pandemic brought about changes in our jobs, family, friends, finances, and within ourselves. And we have seen whole communities across the nation, from big cities to small towns, transform dramatically due to the increase in police brutality, labor strikes across all types of job markets, and a national reckoning around race, voting, policies, careers, and migration. The pandemic gave us a pause to consider all of these factors that come with American life. Here at Immigrantly, we take a closer look at these intersections in identity and explore the issues that spark conversation and enact change. That is why I am so excited to welcome back Tanvi Misra for today's episode. Tanvi is an award-winning independent journalist focused on migration, urban policy, and criminal justice. In one of her most recent articles, Tanvi interviewed four women, from community leaders to activists, to paint a portrait of how migrant communities in New York City push through unjust circumstances. This story not only highlights what the women have done for their communities during the pandemic, but that these women and their communities deserve to take up space in the conversation. The resilience and passion in their activism is constantly at work and has yielded progress that we will get updates about today. When I interviewed Tanvi in February, we discussed the position of migration within American discourse and the multi-layered identity found in immigrant communities. Tanvi's work has been featured in The Atlantic, Bloomberg City Lab, The Guardian, NPR, BBC, and of course, The Fuller Project. Today, Tanvi has returned to talk about the process and focus behind this collaborative article that represents the advocacy found in immigrant communities. So let's get into it. Thank you so much for coming, Tanvi. It's a pleasure to see you in person finally. We spoke once, right? This was in February.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And today we are sitting right across from each other. And first I want to congratulate you on your article for the Fuller Project. My team loved your piece. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about the article was how authentic and real it was, so no bells and whistles attached. I feel like as I was reading it, I could tell that the stories that you were telling were as they came.
Mm-hmm.
There was no embellishment.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a very honest account mm-hmm. of all the four women and what they went through. But I want to understand the process.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose the people that you chose?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the motivation behind this? How did this article come about?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the goal was to really capture an aspect of these women, you know, and their worlds and sort of their experiences during COVID. And the reason that I thought of this was, you know, I cover immigration, so I keep getting all of these studies and all of these pitches from publicists and things like that. And sometimes you sift through one and it it may not be the story that you're working on, but it gives you the seed for another story. And one of the this sort of came in the form of a study, or it was a research paper by the Migration Policy Institute. And they'd released something on immigrant women, specifically working class immigrant women. And there, and I've cited it in the story later on, but it was looking at unemployment among immigrant women and how drastic it was during COVID. So that COVID like fall or plummet was really stark and had not been as stark among any, you know, sort of other subgroups that they'd looked at. So that sort of gave me, you know, a sense of a curiosity, I guess. I just wanted to know what was happening there. And then also, you know, I'm sure you remember, I was seeing all of these stories in the New York Times and elsewhere where, you know, these moms were being profiled as like, you know, women who are having to deal with not only their jobs, but also childcare at home. And so, you know, I'd been reading those stories and I kept thinking, where are the immigrant women, especially the ones who don't, you know, who don't have the resources to have a nanny or whatever, or other ways or other support? So I guess those things kind of combined, dovetailed with each other, and that's really how the story came to be. How did I find these women? So I think I went through some of my sources who were working and organizing these communities. And I came across these women, and these are not the only women I interviewed. I interviewed a few other women as well. And all of their stories are very compelling. So it wasn't that I was, you know, but I think there was something about these women that really just jumped out of the paper for me, like or the page, you know. It just kind of, as I was transcribing their audio, like I just felt just their humanity, right? Yeah. Like their strength and resilience, and like, you know, they're really funny, you know, and they're like sort of zest for life despite the real hardship that they went through this year.
You know, Tanvi, there's so much to unpack here, and what really fascinated me about this article was the ground realities of immigrant identity, because there is so much fixation on quote-unquote American dream, that myth, right? And how we uphold it through these stories of how people make it here, and we just completely erase the ground realities or the hardships that come along the way. What I'm curious to know, because in your article it says that when unemployment happened, it happened more, like disproportionately more within immigrant communities, immigrant women. Was it same across the board for white-collar professionals versus working-class immigrant women, or was there some differences there?
There were definitely differences. So I think, you know, obviously there was job loss across the board, but the types of jobs that these working-class women tend to do were just much more vulnerable to the kind of economic collapse that happened, right? So nail salon workers, Goma is a nail salon worker, there was no one going in to get their nails done, obviously, because everyone was scared of COVID. So there's just no jobs. All of those jobs dried up. Veronica is a domestic worker, right? And no one was asking for their houses to be cleaned because they were too scared of COVID. So, you know, those kinds of gigs, it was basically like all of these gigs that, you know, regulars that they had lined up, that just started disappearing. And there's no... because these jobs are often, you know, a little bit just very prone to the whims of, you know, that local market, but the economy and like so many other things, that effect was almost immediate for all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think maybe some of the other, you know, sectors of the economy, people working in other sectors, you know, white collar jobs, etc., started feeling that crunch a little bit later. But, you know, in March, April, it was immediate for these women.
You know, it's so interesting because it just makes us realize our privilege. You and I are both immigrant women, right? But we come from, like, the backgrounds that we come from, the way we migrated to America is different. It was such an introspective moment for me as I was reading the article. But talking about Veronica, you start your article with her story. What was so special about Veronica and her hunger strike that you decided to open the article with that?
Well, I think I opened the article with her because, A, I think I've always just found people who go on hunger strike really fascinating, and like I'm kind of in awe of them because I can't even stand 2 minutes of hunger.
It's very hard, right?
I break very easy that way. So I think it's just people underestimate what it does to your body, just that physical sense of not being able to have any food. And I think it takes a great deal of strength. That's one. The second is that I feel like the hunger strike that she and other workers put, you know, it got something done. You know, there was a big change, not a small change. It was a huge, you know, the fact that they got so much funding eventually. Now, we are at a point right now in the year where we know now that that funding was not even enough. You know, that fund has been completely drained. They're asking for more money. So obviously it wasn't enough, but it was still so much money, and they were able to do that. And, you know, it just kind of shows you that there's so much power, you know, at that level too. People don't think that one person or two people have power, and it often seems like they don't. And I think in most cases, I would say they don't. But they were able to band together and kind of create it really out of nothing. And I think that I find that very awe-inspiring.
That's so true. And especially with hunger strike, as you said, it's physical and mental way of resisting something, of advocacy, of activism.
I've seen this also be a really powerful tool among South Asian, you know, the South Asian immigrants who are in detention in the United States. They often launch hunger strikes in order to get better treatment, in order to get attention, in order to get parole if they've been detained indefinitely. And as you know, this tactic goes back to, you know, the freedom struggle and stuff. So I've always wondered that about that connection, because I've heard so many times and I've covered so many times this technique being used in detention by South Asian in particular, but not only, but South Asian detainees in particular. So I've always been fascinated with that. Mm. And I think it's a very powerful tool, obviously, as we've seen.
And it happens a lot in India and Pakistan.
Right.
It's a very powerful tool, as you said, for resistance.
Right.
And I saw that growing up. You're absolutely right. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. I feel like there's some sort of cultural memory there or like some sort of, you know, it's almost traditional in a certain sense, and somehow it's being carried over, and I think that's fascinating. So to your question, I think what my goal was with this story was just to kind of give space to some people who, you know, you might run into. Like, these are just ordinary people. They're not, you know, but they've done extraordinary things even in their everyday, and I think that deserves space. And so I think that was my goal. Like, I just wanted a little, these are mini portraits, you know, kind of these women. And that's all I really wanted. I wanted to kind of give you a glimpse. Obviously, they're much more than what is on the page, but just give you a sense of who these people were. And, you know, you might run into a Goma or, like, you know, Arlette. And, you know, hopefully people will have gone and seen her exhibit and her photographs, because she really cares about, you know, like, her community and wants to really document them. And she just is, you know, she said so many things in our interview that still have stayed with me, you know. And so same with Goma. I feel like we chatted about her life, like, you know, from the very beginning of when she came to the US. Obviously couldn't use all of that, but I got to know her a little bit, you know. When I went to take her photo, she sent me back with frozen momos. You know, she's just, these are really just human and interesting ladies. And I'm just very lucky that I got to know them through my work. But, like, I'm hoping that the readers see who they are you know, just a glimpse or a window of who they are.
Absolutely. And we will be talking to Goma and Arlet later in the episode. So we'll find out about the progress and stuff. Now, was there something that really surprised you about these women? Because I'm sure there were certain expectations you had going into these interviews, or maybe assumptions about women. As a journalist, I'm sure you've interacted with so many people, right? But was there something which really surprised you and you were like, what? Like, could this happen? Is this real? Anything like that?
I don't know if there was something that is that... I don't think there was anything that sensational, but I'm always kind of surprised by how certain people open themselves up to me. Huh. When I, like, Arlette received me at the ferry station in Staten Island and, like, took me around, drove me back. You know, we went and had dinner at her favorite Thai restaurant. She showed me the park. She told me that Staten Island is the borough of parks. I had never known that. I probably would not have known that unless it was for her. But it was really nice of her to take out all that time and talk at length about not just what I was talking about, but a lot of other things. And really just, yeah, I mean, same with Goma. Like, I feel like those are the two that I spent a lot of time with. And so, you know, I'm just always surprised. I don't expect that because I'm a very guarded person myself. And so, I tend to be, open myself up only once I'm comfortable with people. Yeah. And I feel like I really always get surprised when people are not like that and so open and friendly and, like, just invite you into their lives and be like, oh, this is what it is. And Goma, I just loved the fact that she had a pet pigeon.
Yeah, I saw the pigeon.
Yeah, it was so amazing. So when she talked about that, like, I was like, okay, I need to come and see this pigeon. Like, this is amazing. And obviously she named the pigeon Pari, which is, you know, angel. Yeah. And when I went to her house, she, like, introduced me and the pigeon would keep coming. And, like, while I was trying to take her photo, keep coming and sitting on my... either on my head or on my shoulder. So that was pretty funny. But she also had all of these photos of herself when she was younger. And, you know, her lipstick was always on point. And I just loved, like, those little details about her life that she was willing to share with me.
Before we wrap up this interview, I may be digressing a bit, but since you cover immigration and migration so much, Tanvi, I, as someone who is an immigrant, who talks to a lot of immigrants and second-gen people, I still feel, unfortunately, there is this stigma and taboo attached to immigrant identity in America, despite the fact that there are 44 million immigrants, 18 million people with one parent who's an immigrant. Why is that still happening, especially in America, of all the places?
Yeah, I think it's because I know that there's this narrative of America being the country of immigrants, but I think that came a lot later. Actually, originally, it's a pretty xenophobic country.
Yeah.
From the early, like, late 1800s, when the first restrictions on immigration came about against, and they were explicitly racist, explicitly against Chinese laborers who were, you know, coming to work in the West. And so that has informed everything. That has informed the 1920s, you know, when they put in those quotas. And then while the 1965 immigration laws, like, opened up, you know, America to, like, the rest of the world, some of those things have still stayed. I mean, there's still a lot of discrimination. It's still, like, you know, even if you get your green card or you get your citizenship, you're never American enough. And that's sort of how they sort of challenge it. But it's so smart, right? If you keep telling someone or keep challenging someone's, like, identity that way, it's no wonder that there are some immigrants who try to be so American that they even alienate other immigrants, you know, other new immigrants. Like, they keep saying, we're not like them. We're American. We're not like them.
You know, there's tendency to self-loathe in a way.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I don't want to be associated with immigrant identity. I have so many friends who were born and raised in Pakistan, India, other parts of the world, and they'll be like, we are not immigrants. We are naturalized citizens, and I'm like, but you're still immigrants. Those two identities are not mutually exclusive, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's very complex, and I think there's, there's one aspect of it I've always thought of is, like, it's so hard to immigrate that, like, once people immigrate, they're like, oh, we did it, so we must be special or something. Yeah. You know, I'm like, maybe some people think that way, or, you know, other people think, like, maybe they had to give up so much to be here that, like, they feel like, oh, now we have to commit all the way, you know, or something, including all the racism. Like, I don't know.
People say that's so true. You yeah. know what? Yeah. I asked you this question in February, and I'm going to ask you this question again. Sure. If you were to define America, and this is something that I ask my guests, you know this, you mm-hmm. were a guest. And since we are in the studio and we are talking about immigration, I want to get your take again. It may have changed from last time.
Oh, God. I probably also was stumped by this last time. You would have thought I would have got a better answer this time. I mean, I think it's like an idea, right? Maybe that's what I said last time. I don't remember. But it's an idea, and there's aspects of it that are illusions and aspects of it that are, you know, false. And there are aspects of it that are aspirational, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think there's an idea of it, and I don't think it's true in real life. But, you know, there are people who are trying to make it true, and that is, I think, I mean, that's commendable, I guess. But I also think, like, I don't love I would argue, like, India is, I would define India a similar way, maybe. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, you know, India is a place where there's a lot of different voices, a lot of different people. And it's an idea. And I think right now the reality on the ground is like a complete opposite of, I mean, let me be honest, the idea was never realized. You know, it was never like a secular socialist democracy, as it says in the Indian constitution. But what it currently is like the antithesis of that, you know. And I feel like it's similarly with America. So I don't think America is exceptional necessarily in any way. But I do think it is similarly an idea. And, you know, all nations are just ideas, right? It's just like what those ideas are different. So
I love it. Tanvi, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're always welcome to come to Immigrantly. After talking to Tanvi, we decided to include a follow-up with two women included in the article to talk about the progress of sorts. I am so excited to welcome Goma Yonjan and Arlit Sipida. Goma, as you already know, is a nail salon worker who migrated to New York more than 15 years ago. She's pushing the federal government for a clear citizenship path for temporary protected status holders like herself. Arlit is a visual artist and a photographer who was born in the United States and grew up in the Dominican Republic. In her exhibit, Essential Immigrant Stories, she captured the sense of loss during the pandemic within her tight-knit Staten Island community. We interviewed them separately. Here are snippets from our very fruitful and insightful conversation. You did photo documentary project, which is so impressive, Arlit. And before we delve into it, I just want to get an idea of how it all started.
Sure. So I was in the midst of getting hired for my current job. And my previous job was in higher education. At private college, and I've always worked in community engagement. That's my field of preference, and I've had plenty of experience working with community members. And I was applying for this job at La Colmena as its deputy director, and I'm also a visual artist by career. So I was applying for a local grant with Staten Island Arts, our local council, Arts Council. And during that time, we were, you know, nine months into the pandemic, and we were seeing a lot of news coverage, but I didn't see a lot of people from the community, people who look like me, people, immigrants, right? So I'm like, I felt that there was a need to highlight the experiences and voices of the people from the community, which were not being highlighted or their voices amplified. So I always try to have to live a very wholesome life in a way that I try to pair my passions with my work. You know, in America in particular, people compartmentalize their life. Like, you know, work is work and my personal life is my personal life. And, you know, my passions are my passions or hobbies. So like they don't mix. And I'm like, no, I want to be able to integrate my art into my everyday work. And Essential Immigrant Stories came about as a result of trying to merge my work with La Colmena, which works with essential immigrants, with day laborers, domestic workers, and other low-wage workers who are of immigrant descent, with my interest in highlighting the voices of the communities through my photography. And so I applied for the grant. I got it. And this grant allowed me to, one, get to know the constituency that we serve much better. The process of interviewing people about their experiences with COVID is a very intimate one. I asked two questions for all 27 interviewees. So I interview them and ask two questions. What was the biggest challenge that you had to face? And but what was an opportunity that came out of this pandemic? And these two simple, very broad questions generated a whole bunch of different answers. Very moving ones, very simple ones, very surprising ones. You'll be shocked to hear. And also I try to have a very varied range of people, from children to adults to elderly and everything in between.
Was there some response that was surprising to you, or something that really stuck with you? Like, you were like, oh my gosh, you know, I wasn't expecting this.
Absolutely. There's a couple of stories that were very, very strong. I'm going to mention three. One was of a mother that contracted the virus. First, her husband did, then she did. And her biggest fear was to leave her children and, you know, leave them orphaned and not being able to be with them to care for them. So that really touched me as a mother myself. You know, that's definitely something that a mother fears all the time, not to
be there, especially
with young children. So that was very moving. I cried listening to her because the anguish and desperation was deep. And that was really strong. And then there was another woman that I interviewed, and that one was like devastating. She talk about like everything wrong coming at the same time. That happened to her.
Oh no.
She's a nurse in an emergency room and actually an operating room. And because operations were not being done, they all transferred them to attend COVID patients, right? In ICU, intubated and so on. So her mother contracted the virus and ended up in her emergency room, and she could not save her mother. So yeah, I and then not only that, but her dad and her mom were married for 55 years, so that she had to deal with her father feeling completely lost after losing his lifelong partner. Yeah, so it was really hard to listen to all this. And then on top of that, she was getting separated from her husband. I mean,
gosh,
how much
that's rough
can you take? And she's so strong. So that was really powerful. And I asked her what kept her going, and she said, my children keep me going. So that was very moving. And lastly, one story was of my neighbor. I interviewed my neighbor. And before this project, we never really talked. We just said hello, right? But I went and I said hello, and I asked her if I could interview her. She said yes. And then they told me about the loss of their dad, which is actually mentioned in the piece that Tambi wrote. And basically, you know, this is a family of immigrants that came from Mexico for a better life. And the father picked up cans as a way of living and brought all of his 6 children to the United States, picking up cans. And he died of COVID. And they were devastated because they were orphaned. Their mother had been killed in Mexico. So the father became the only supporter. And when he died, they all felt that their universe had collapsed. And that was so hard to hear, you know. And then what she said, it was that he was working hard to build a home back in Mexico, and he did. Then he died. So he said, what are we going to do? No one wants to go back. My family's here, my children are here. You know, he never got to go back home. And it was like we come to for this dream, you know, the American dream, and sometimes we just leave the best behind. That really touched me. It was so hard.
That's so true. And I'm so glad that you were able to showcase all these stories, because most of these stories are never covered in mainstream media. These are hidden stories.
That's right.
That we don't hear, we don't see. We only see them when people like you take initiative, and it is tied to funding, right? You mentioned funding, and I want to circle back to that. How much of it was probably contingent on you getting funding?
I would say all of it. All of it, because I would have probably be curious still, but maybe not really take it as serious as I did because of this commitment through the organization. It allowed me to expand the audience, that's for sure. The funding allowed me to reach and produce the photos that otherwise probably I wouldn't have done, probably would have been just digital. But I'm also making a little book, a photo book.
Oh, nice.
Stories, yes. So that each participant would have a book in the story.
Alet, has your idea of the quote-unquote American dream shifted after doing this documentary project? Has it changed at all?
You know, as a child of immigrants, I would say that the American dream as we knew it existed, it just has become a nightmare. Because the mindset, I would say, of this country towards immigrants has shifted.
Right.
Something negative. Before, when my grandma came in the 1950s, this was a place of opportunities, truly a place of opportunities for immigrants. Right now, it's more like an obstacle course.
Yeah. You know what I feel? It's like the U.S. has gone through a number of iterations of what it means to be an immigrant. And U.S. has this love-hate relationship with immigrant identity, right? So if we go far back, we know there was Chinese Exclusion Act and there were Japanese internment camps. Yeah. And then, as you mentioned, maybe 50s were better and there were more opportunities. And now somehow America is regressing to that discrimination and that hatred towards people who are such an integral part of the American fabric, right?
Yes.
I am an immigrant. You are a child of immigrants. It's crazy how America is still trying to understand its American identity and is going through this identity crisis. Arlette, if I were to flip that script and ask you to tell me one challenge that you faced during COVID and one opportunity, what would that be?
Oh, wow. That's a good one. I think there were multiple challenges during COVID. Personally, I was shifting careers, literally. And there was a little bit of job insecurity and uncertainty. I was like looking for a job in the middle of a pandemic. You know how nerve-wracking that is?
Yeah, I can't imagine. You're right.
And then the level of uncertainty was disgusting, because if you didn't hear back or didn't get a call back, you didn't know if it was because of the pandemic or because you didn't do good in the interview. It was hard. It was hard to figure that out. And then, of course, you know, I decided to take a job that had nothing to do with what I was doing before. So that was a risk in and of itself. So that was hard to start a new job with things that, you know, with all these limitations. On a more personal level, you know, of course, I'm a parent, and we were trying to do of a teenager. It was hard. You couldn't be a mother and a teacher and an employee in your home at the same time. It was like, I talk about identity crisis. We were all having identity crisis. There was no way to like even pause one role versus the other, right?
Yeah.
I kept telling people, you know, when we went to work, we ordered lunch. If you're home, you got to cook it.
And you don't even think about lunch, right? There were incidents where I would not eat until 3 p.m.
Yes.
You know, that happens too. Yeah.
Yes, because we would book meetings back to back to back to back and not even schedule a bathroom break because we didn't have to quote unquote travel.
Right.
We forgot about our needs as humans.
Yeah.
I know, I hear you. It was tough. But then in terms of opportunities, and this is when I actually started thinking about myself a little more. There was time for reflection. There was time for risk taking, and there was time. This is how I came back to my artwork, by the way, because I was so focused on work that I neglected my artwork for several years. And I said, you know what? Life is too short. That's another thing. You became very aware of your mortality. And I'm going to do things that I really enjoy and that have meaning for me. And that's how, in a way, this kind of like motivation to apply for this grant came from. And it has become a fantastic opportunity to meet many new people, to hear stories, to have exhibits, to have doors open. So I would say those have been the opportunities that came out of the pandemic for me. You know, just understanding that life is precious and time is limited.
Arlette, this was so good. And I am so proud of the work that you're doing, because we need those stories out. We don't see them. I am so sick and tired of mainstream media creating narratives about you and I. And I'm so glad we are doing it ourselves.
Thank you.
And thank you for doing this. This was so good. Thank you. Just for our listeners, you are going to translate for Goma Didi. Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Prarthana Gurum, and I am the Director of Campaigns and Communications at Adhikar. And I'll be serving as an interpreter for Goma Didi today. And also there may be some pieces on our work and the campaigns that I can also answer as well, in addition to the interpretation support.
I want to get some updates on your work, which was featured in that article, We Have to Survive. What progress has your organization, Adhikar, made to clear up citizenship for temporary protected status immigrants? And I believe Goma Didi is part of that advocacy work, right?
Yes. उहाँले चाहिँ के भन्नुभयो भने अब तान्वीसँग चाहिँ कुरा भएको थियो होइन अब जस्तो त्यो आर्टिकल पनि उसले पढ्यो होइन तर अब तान्वीसँग पनि कुराकानी गर्दाखेरि चाहिँ अब तपाईँको जेस अब तपाईँ कस्तो अब रमाइलो रहेछ होइन तर एट द सेम टाइम रमाइलो मात्रै होइन तपाईँको कतिको डेडिकेसन रहेछ अब यो काममा होइन भन्नेमा चाहिँ उसले सेयर गरेको थियो त्यही भएर म एक्साइटेड छु भन्ने छ उसले अनि त्यही भएर चाहिँ अहिले यो सिटिजनसिपको अभियानमा चाहिँ तपाईँ चाहिँ किन लाग्नु भएको र के को लागि चाहिँ इन्भल्भ हुनुभएको के को लागि गरिरहनु भएको छ
ए त्यो भनेको धन्यवाद सानपीलाई भेटेर एकदम खुसी लाग्यो सानपी अल्सो एकदमै नाइस पर्सन रहेछ
Thank you so much, Tanvi. I'm so glad that you were able to connect to Tanvi. She's such a nice person. I really like her.
अनि पुरा गरे सानसँग राम्रो भयो तर यो टिपिएसको बारेमा चाहिँ म चाहिँ जुन दिन टिपिएस भयो हाम्रो नेपालको लागि होइन त्यहाँदेखि नै क्याम्पिङमा लागिरहेछ किनभने यो टिपिएसले चाहिँ हामी कागज विहीन मान्छेहरूलाई कागज नभएको मान्छेहरूलाई एउटा के हुन्छ साहस दिएको छ अब हामीले टिपिएस भएपछि लिगल भयो लिगल भएपछि हामीले यसमा ट्याक्स तिर्नु पायो अथवा हामीले के काम लिगली कामहरू सबै गर्नु पायो बाहिर जाँदाखेरि नै हामी ए हामी लिगली छु भने ढुक्क मन खोलेर हिँड्नु पायो अब लिगल नहुँदाखेरि चाहिँ डर हुन्थ्यो नि त्यस्तो डर हुन्थ्यो इभन मैले पहिला त्यति मात्रै भन्ने
सो यु नो दिस क्याम्पेन फर सिटिजनसिप यु नो आई हैव बीन इन्भॉल्वड विथ फर मेनी इयर्स विथ अधिकार You know, it's a part of it started with TPS, which is temporary protected status. We got TPS as Nepalis in 2015, and since then, it was such a breath of relief for us to get TPS before we'd been living undocumented. And, you know, all of a sudden, we felt more comfortable being able to travel and being able to work freely without any stress or any fear. And we then, you know, we're able to contribute in a different way to the economy and we pay taxes and it just really changed our lives to have TPS.
So, Goma Didi, did you face any challenges within the communities that you organized with while you work on your advocacy work? Are there any challenges and how do you handle them?
Just so I lead it, I go, okay, जस्तो अहिले काम गर्दाखेरि अब कम्युनिटीसँग काम गर्दाखेरि कम्युनिटीभित्र अथवा यही टिपिएस क्याम्पेन सिटिजनसिपको क्याम्पेनभित्र काम गर्दाखेरि चाहिँ केही जस्तो च्यालेन्जहरू केही कुराहरू आउँछ त्यस्तो
आउँछ नि अब जस्तै कति मान्छेले अब यो समाजमा काम गर्दाखेरि टिपिएस भएको मान्छे ढुक्क भएर जान्छौँ होइन तर यस्तो हुँदो रहेछ कि च्यालेन्ज भने कि अब कोही अब हामी कागज नहुनेलाई जो टिपिएस पाएको छ उनीहरू एकदमै प्राउड भएर अगाडि हिँड्छौँ होइन तर अब कमिटीमा कस्तो हुन्छ को चाहिँ कोही सिटिजन हुन्छ उनीहरूले मतलब गर्दैन नि त अरूलाई उनीहरूलाई हेल्प गर्न चाहँदैन त्यस्तो च्यालेन्जहरू कति हुन्छ कि अब जस्तै टिपिएस हुनेहरूलाई त बिचरा गाह्रो छ नि त जस्तै मैले म भनौँ अमेरिका आएको 25 वर्ष भयो होइन 25 वर्ष आयो नेल्समा काम गरेको $30 सुरु गरेको मैले अब मैले जति दुःख भोगेँ नि मसँग कागज नहुँदाखेरि अब त्यो ओनरले मलाई दबाब गरेको मैले अब लाइसेन्स लिनु गाह्रो भएको त्यो चिज कति च्यालेन्ज भोगेँ नि त मैले अनि त्यस्तो चिजहरूले गर्दाखेरि चाहिँ म चाहिँ के भन्न चाहन्छु भन्दाखेरि जति मैले दुःख भोगेँ नि अरूले चाहिँ नभोगोस् मैले गरेर के हुन्छ भने मैले बोलेर के हुन्छ भने उनीहरूलाई राम्रो होस् भन्न चाहन्छु
You know, I think there are many challenges that come up when doing this type of work in our community. I think one of the things is that there is a fear among those who don't have papers or even as TPS for us to come forward and share, I have TPS or to say that I'm undocumented. And I think I also see that there are individuals who are citizens, for example, who say, oh, well, you know, I'm a citizen, so I'm fine. You know, I don't have any responsibility to do anything else. And, you know, I've been here for 25 years. And, you know, from the very beginning, I worked at a nail salon. I was only earning $30 a day. And, you know, I was working in such types of conditions where I was really working under the pressure of the employer. And And, you know, I was in such a situation working undocumented, and, you know, now I'm here, and in a lot of ways, I see it as my responsibility to be able to say, okay, well, you know, I went through all this, and so why not do something, right, for others and for ourselves now that I'm here?
Prarthna, this question is for both of you, for Goma Didi and for you. Are you disappointed in current administration's lackluster response to advocacy around immigration status, be it TPS or DACA?
तपाईलाई जस्तो अहिलेको जस्तो बाइडेन एडमिनिस्ट्रेसन नयाँ प्रशासनले केही नगरेको कुराहरूले गर्दाखेरि तपाईँलाई कस्तो लागिरहेछ अहिले?
उहाँले गर्नुपर्ने हो, अस्ति पनि गर्छु होइन, लिगल के गर्छु भन्नुभएको छ नि त उसले. अब उसले यो भोट चिन्नुभन्दा अगाडि, प्रेसिडेन्ट हुनुभन्दा अगाडि उसले बाजा गरेको छ, त्यो चिज पुरा गरोस् भन्न चाहन्छु. तर अब हामीलाई अड्किरहन्छ नि उहाँले पुरा नगर्दा.
Yeah, I think this is interpreting for Goma Didi. You know, the Biden administration, when they were campaigning before they won, had said that this was something that they would fight for, right?
Mm. So
it was really important. And so what we're seeing is no response on that, and it's getting stuck, right? It's getting stuck.
Right.
And so I think it is very much something that we're keeping an eye on, right? We're noticing that their campaign promise is not being made.
Hmm.
And I'll just, I mean, I think for myself, like, I think I completely agree with Goma Didi, and, you know, I think there are definitely, it is a disappointment, but at the same time, it's not, the fight isn't over. There are still avenues, like the window has not closed yet. And for us to say, I mean, this is part of what accountability is, right? And
right.
You know, we didn't mobilize voters, or we didn't do all of this work around you know, organizing our communities to say, okay, you know, go ahead and do this. We'll just sit back and watch you all do it, right? It's, I think a part of our work is making sure that we hold electeds accountable to the campaign promises that they made, and we really organize the communities that they're able to push forward the demands that they've been, you know, saying for years now.
What keeps you motivated, Goma Didi, with all the work that you're doing and pressures of it at times?
तपाईँले चाहिँ अब जस्तो यो सबै कुराहरू हुँदाखेरि चाहिँ अब तपाईँले चाहिँ जस्तो तपाईँ चाहिँ अब इन्गेज गरिरहनु भएको छ, कन्टिन्यू गरिरहनु भएको छ, र तपाईँलाई चाहिँ केले गर्दाखेरि चाहिँ मोटिभेट हुन्छ? किन जस्तो तपाईँ चाहिँ अब दिनदिनै आउनुहुन्छ?
किन भन्दाखेरि त्यो मेडिटेसन कसरी भयो भन्दाखेरि, जस्तै मेरो आफ्नै जबमा नेल सेलोनमा मैले धेरै दुःख पायो, एकदमै हार्डवर्क गरेँ नि. अब त्यो जस्तै लाइसेन्स लिनमा धेरै गाह्रो भएन, अनि हाम्रो लाइसेन्स पास भयो नेट्स क्याम्पिङ गर्दाखेरि हामीले आफ्नो नेपाली भाषामा चाहिँ लाइसेन्स दिनु पाएँ, जाँच दिनु पाएँ. त्यसले गर्दा मलाई एकदमै झनै प्राउड भयो कि मैले के गरौँ भन्ने फिल भयो. जो मैले दुःख पाएको थिएँ त्यतिखेर ल्याङ्ग्वेज, अब हाम्रो त गाह्रो हुन्छ नि इङ्ग्लिस खोज्नु, होइन, बल्ल बल्ल पास गरेको त्यो के भन्छ सर्टिफिकेट लाइसेन्स लिनुलाई. तर त्यो लाइसेन्स चाहिँ दिदी बहिनीहरूले कतिले लिन सकेको थिएन. हामीले 2 वर्ष क्याम्पिङ गर्दाखेरि चाहिँ सिरियलमा बोल्नु नि गएको, म बोलेपछि चाहिँ पास भयो हाम्रो नेपाली ल्याङ्ग्वेजमा चाहिँ जाँच दिनु पाउने भनेर. त्यसले चाहिँ पुरा दिदी बहिनीहरू हेप्पी भयो, जाँच दिनु पायो, होइन, अब इजिली उनीहरू काम गर्नु पायो. त्यसले चाहिँ मलाई एकदम मोटिभेसन भएर
So, you know, I think this is a good question. And what is the big thing that brings me motivation to keep coming to Adhikar and being engaged? You know, years ago, when I was working in a nail salon, and it was so difficult to get a license as someone who didn't speak English, and there were so many barriers, and I really endured that. And then I got involved in Adhikar through the campaign for nail salon workers' rights in New York. And we fought for access to licensing in our own. I even testified. We organized and we ran this together. And then we won. We were able to win licensing access in Nepali. We were able to win the ability to have a course in Nepali for all of these sisters, who now they're able to access licensing to become nail technicians, you know, without the types of challenges that I had to go through. And I think I saw how that change happened, and I was a part of that change, and I was able to bring that type of change, and that makes me really happy. And that also encourages me to know that in every, not just in now salon workers' rights, but in every aspect of our work, we can bring some type of change, right? If you experience suffering, and you can bring some type of change.
I love that. So in the end, I'll request Goma Didi to sing something for us.
Nepali Tinai dadai nahi mero tinai nahi re na bole timi sanga na bole tinai dadai nahi mero tinai nahi re.
Thank you.
I love it. It's so beautiful. You know, it's so calming. Thank you for doing that. And thank you for this wonderful interview. Tanvi's article came from a collaboration with three news publications, The Fuller Project, The City, and Documented. Documented is a nonprofit news site covering New York City's immigrants and the policies that affect their lives. The Fuller Project is a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to groundbreaking journalism that focuses on women's perspectives to give readers the full story. All to raise awareness, expose injustice, and push for accountability. The City is a nonprofit, nonpartisan digital news platform that commits to hard-hitting reporting about New York and its boroughs to better inform people. Their mission is to reconnect New Yorkers to local news, dig into their concerns, and set the agenda or what drives public conversation. Thank you for listening to this episode of Immigrantly. Our team extends our gratitude to the Fuller Project and the City for collaborating with us, and to our special guests, Tanvi, Goma, and Arlette. You can find Tanvi's article on fullerproject.org and connect with her on Twitter at Tanvi M. For more Immigrantly, follow us on Twitter at immigrantly_pod and on Instagram at immigrantlypod. And of course, tune in next Tuesday for a new episode wherever you listen to your podcasts. Oh.